So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So this film explores the journey of the many people involved in the cycling team in the Paralympic journey to Paris in 2024. Now, through the film, you're obviously able to connect with a lot of the athletes and explore the many barriers these athletes are able to overcome. So how inspiring was it to be so close-hand and experience the journeys of the many athletes?
I think it was fantastic. I guess for me, I hadn't... About 25 years ago, my brother and I went along to the Sydney 2000 Paralympic Games. At the time, I was quite depressed. I was going through quite severe cystic acne and was on medication for that. And unfortunately, the side effect of that medication was depression. And so going along to the Paralympic Games and seeing athletes from all around the world achieve amazing results despite their disabilities was such a... inspiring moment for both my brother and I. So to get this project off the ground and finally realise some of the thoughts and questions that we had back then has just been fantastic. And the athletes have all been so lovely and welcoming and supportive of the project. And
So it really provides a look at the different challenges experienced by people with from a range of disabilities. We have athletes that have brain and spinal injuries, you've got sight impairments, neurological conditions, and that's just a few. Was it important to highlight the sort of various ways in which people with different kinds of ability are affected differently when it comes to becoming an athlete?
Yeah, it was one of the things that my brother and I both co-wrote the documentary together, and one of the things that we wanted to do was explore the different reasons that someone might find themselves in the team there, and although we cover classification as part of that process in the documentary just quite on a quite a loose level, what we explored was effectively finding in Kane, Corey and Emily almost covering those three different ways. So first being an acquired injury, so that might that be a traumatic injury in the case of Corey, who had a series of accidents when he was younger, or for Emily it was acquiring a disease, which was MS, and then the third way being being born with a congenital condition, so that was Kane, and being born with albinism, which affects his eyesight and puts him into the low vision category. So, that's how we explored in the writing, how to cover those different angles. And that's sort of course, there's many other ways that, you can be in para sport, with limb deficiencies, limb loss, the cerebral palsy, how things affect the body with cycling. But they're the three main ways that we wanted to explore. And we found Emily, Corey, Kane and his pilot Luke to be just so fantastic to work with, and their stories were just all so unique but all still carrying so many different levels, and one of the big things being invisible disability and invisible suffering, which is a big thing for us. And we think that cycling being the vessel for such a huge important message there.
Was it a challenge to gain trust with people? Did you have to spend time just... How much of a challenge was it just getting people? I mean, sometimes you experience some people in quite vulnerable situations.
It was a challenge at first. There was it was hard to originally get off the ground and be able to get over and be with the team in Paris. And there was some communication issues there, unfortunately. So for those first few days. There was the assumption that I was there as, that one of the team's sponsors is just making a YouTube video, where in, actual fact I was there, wanting to make a feature documentary about these guys. And so that was quite challenging at the beginning. But I was able to go home after two or three nights and have a good old cry over the phone with my partner. And say, dear God, have I done the wrong thing here? Maybe I have done the wrong thing. And she said, no, I think you're doing the right thing. Stick with it. And, I called my editor, sent him some footage overnight, and he was able to cut together a 90-second trailer of the footage I'd already shot. And I was able to show that to the team the next day, and there was just a massive amount of interest and excitement and buzz in the team. And that's when things turned around, and we were able to sort of, move along and get to know the guys on the team really well, and they're all really welcoming, and even the support staff were just amazing as well, always making sure that I was drinking water and I was fed and making sure that I was, not overworking myself and getting enough sleep, which, of course, was impossible, but,
So we also have here our multi-gold medal record-holding cyclist, Emily Pichicola. And you were diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, which upturned your life and your successful career. That must have been a difficult time adjusting to the limitations of MS.
Yeah, the limitations weren't necessarily immediate. The thing with MS is it builds up over time, depending on how many relapses you have and how many plaques you've got, either in your brain or on your spinal cord. So I was really unlucky that the first 3 years were pretty horrible for me. I was pretty sick pretty consistently. So every 3 or 4 months I'd be back in hospital getting massive doses of steroids. So it was pretty grim early doors.
That's that unknown aspect too of not knowing what's happening in front of that must be really difficult. How do you sort of structure your life?
Well, I remember the first neurologist that I'd saw who actually gave me the diagnosis had said to me at the time, look, we won't put you on medication. We can't because you've only had one clinical relapse. You need to have two to be put on medication. So you'll just have to wait for that to happen. And I said, well, I've got a trip overseas booked in 4 months to Europe. Am I going to be able to take that trip or should I cancel it? He said, oh, it's up to you. He goes, but what usually happens early in the disease is that people go blind. So that might happen while you're away. You'll have to think about that. And I remember just thinking, this doesn't feel that great to me, just to sit around and wait for something to happen. So I'm lucky that one of my friend's dads was one of the premier sort of radiologists in the country at the time. And so I reached out to her and asked if he knew anyone who was an MS specialist, because whilst the neurologist that I'd originally saw was obviously a neurologist, he wasn't an MS specialist. So he did have a recommendation and I went to a different doctor who immediately put me on medication. But unluckily for me, it took us about 7 years to find one that actually stabilised the disease. So, yeah, there's a lot to sort of come to terms with when you're diagnosed with a disease like MS, which is degenerative and, progressive. And if you don't have good doctors and you don't have good people around you, it can be even worse because of all of the unknown stuff. So
how important was cycling to be able to be able to re-engage with community, to be able to keep fit? How important was paracycling to
be honest, it wasn't so much the community initially for me. It was more about regaining a sense of my identity from before I was sick, because I'd always been really fit, active, mm-hmm. healthy throughout my entire life. So being able to get into cycling, which was a suggestion of a friend of mine, it wasn't my idea, that really connected me back into a piece of who I was before, and that sort of started this process of me reclaiming who I was again rather than sort of just being at the behest of the illness to a degree.
So very much about making sure that, the illness doesn't define you, that you're still able to have that sort of agency, I'm sure.
Well, I think early on I was just pretending that everything was fine because I didn't want anyone to look at me any differently. So I spent a lot of time and energy pretending and hiding the struggle. And I was pretty depressed, I think. And so getting back into sport was the first time where I'd been able to really recognise where I'd been through the journey and allowed me to then start to step away from that part of my life, I guess, and sort of step back into who I was and who I could now still be.
So we also have here another gold medalist, and record holder, making me feel a bit inadequate here. So Kobe Boddington, who suffered a brain injury from a motocross accident and also had to wear a tracheostomy tube to help him breathe for years. Now he's now known as the Flying Burrito and bagged a whole host of gold medals. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey going to becoming a gold medalist?
Yeah, so I had my first injury when I was about 10 years old. Yeah, it was a long time ago. So I got hit by a car. I was playing cricket, hit the ball, six and out. Mm-hmm. But someone has to go get the ball. So yeah. I went and got the ball. On the way back, I got cleaned up by a car. So it hit on my right side of the body. So I had a heap of damage on my right side. So fast forward, I'm getting better from that. All I want to do is go back, play footy with my mates, go surfing. But my body never fully got better, so it might have only, especially my arm, it only ever got back to about 70-80%. So then when I was 15, I had a motocross accident. I ended up in a coma for 3 weeks. More damage to the right side of my body, had to learn to walk and talk again. Because I had such a massive brain injury, the doctors were kind of like, well, let's just keep him alive. So they neglected the injuries because it was more important that I was able to survive. So in that, my injuries got really bad on my right side, like my right arm completely got frozen. And so then this 70-80% right side now all the 15 years later, it's only at about 50% strength. And yeah, and same mentality after all my accidents, just want to get better, just want to get back to playing footy with my mates. Mm-hmm. Or now it's riding bike with my friends. But no, I love it.
So, while spectators get to see the finished product of bicycles moving effortlessly at rapid speed, which a lot of preparation goes into the foundation for the success on the track, can you tell us a little bit about how arduous the training regime is when it comes to being a professional being a Paralympian?
Yeah, so I train with the Australian elite sprint men, the able bodies, and I'd like to think I train harder than all of them. And I'm sure if you ask any other para athlete, Emily included, she'll tell you she trains harder than him.
I don't think I train harder, but it's at least as hard. I think that the training is by its nature harder for us because we're trying to do it despite something that's not quite right with our body. So I don't want to discredit the work that they do because they work incredibly hard as well, but we do it with a bigger challenge in front of us.
Yes, that was put grammatically. Correct.
So but what's it like? I mean, you've both got careers. You're an accountant and yep. I believe you do teaching. So, I mean,
I'm not teaching at the moment. I work at the South Australian Sports Institute at the moment.
Well, you're still juggling careers. Yeah. I mean, that must be hard to, I'm assuming you have to get up really early or, to do the training. And you've got also a job to also. What's that like? I mean, that must be really hard to juggle both.
Yeah. So the key is to get into bed nice and early because my day starts at about 4 o'clock. So I get to the gym, do my couple hours in the gym, and then I'm straight to work, do a couple hours at work, and then to the track where I do more training. And then once I get home, it's 4 or 5 o'clock, so make some dinner and jump on the computer and do some more work. So I'm either working or working.
Different sort of work.
So the idea of free time is a bit of a...
yeah, life takes a real hit when you've chosen this.
Yeah, and sure, Em can... That's to her experience.
Yeah, it's much the same, to be honest. It's just work, training, and, I live with my partner who has two kids that we have every other week. So life's pretty full. You don't have a lot of time for socialising, that's for sure.
So what's it like? Let me see. Oh, yeah. So while you get all these years that you're putting all this preparation in, what's it like when you actually, just before the main event, before the race, do you have to deal with the nerves of knowing what it's like when, it could be a split-second difference between, being on the podium or not? What's that situation like when you're just before the event? Is that really difficult?
Yeah, you wonder why the hell you're doing it. I do anyway. I sit there and I'm like, why do I do this to myself? But then you get in the starting gate and it all disappears because you're just in the moment and you're just going through your process and it all just happens. You know that once you take the first pedal stroke, you're not worried about being nervous anymore. You're just doing what you've been trained to do. And you've just got to Corey and I are fairly similar in that we both make sure that when we're coming into those big major championships and the ones that are the pinnacle events, that we tick every box on the way in so that irrespective of the result, we know that there's nothing different that we could have done to make it any better. And you've just got to be happy with whatever the outcome is on the day.
Yeah, the result will be the result.
Yeah. So it's about you trying to sort of, do you prepare beforehand like of how you're going to just focus to take out any sort of distractions, to take out nerves?
What training is.
Yeah.
You're just training for that moment. So literally how many training starts do you reckon you've done in your career so far?
Yeah, quite a lot.
Yeah, but so that when you get in there you don't think, it's just you just do what you've programmed yourself to be able to do.
Yeah, and come race day. Oh, I am the distraction.
We both are for each other. Yeah. But I like a distraction. I like to be really relaxed and happy and positive. Yeah. So I think works for both of us. When we won our gold medals, it was less than 10 minutes apart in awesome. Paris, and we did our warm-up and everything together. So, we had a long time together in the lead into Paris because I'd gone to Brisbane 3 weeks before we went to the staging camp, and we spent that time training together. And every day Corey would come in and he'd be like, how are you going, Em? And I'd be like, I'm okay, Corey. And I'd ask him and he's like, oh, I'm phenomenal. I was like, you've just got to pace this. You can't build too early. The only day I've got to feel, because he was getting angry every day, he goes, one day you're going to come in, you're going to say I'm amazing. And I'm going to be so happy. I said, the only day I'm going to be amazing is race day, because that's the only day it really needs to be. So, and then on the day we were both pretty amazing. So
you could see the bubbles were rising.
Day in, day out.
They were rising. And then I had to tell him, just, it's not race day yet.
So you've got to make sure you peak at the exact right time.
Exactly.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about some of the inspirations. I mean, the Doco show is also the work that goes on behind the scenes. I mean, you've got conditioning, equipment, coaching, and just dealing with all the particular challenges of, you know, of being an elite athlete. Who would be some of the unsung heroes that you'd like to give a shout out to?
I've been asked this question a couple of times and I don't know. Growing up, I always had my own difficulties, so I take inspiration from something they've done, but I've always tried to form my own path in life. But in saying that, in the film itself and just at training, being around all these high-performing athletes and even sitting in this room right now with greatness among me, I'm so inspired.
Including yourself.
So... No, I got a great film guy here and a great athlete and a great producer behind the mic making me blush. So I draw inspiration from everyone because everyone's killing it.
I think for me, the reason that I was able to get on the bike in Paris, like I was going through a relapse at the time, so I have to give a huge shout out to the medical team that was with us. We had Paralympics Australia Dr. Steve Reed with us initially, and then Alice McNamara came in, and their management of me through that period. Like the medical management was pretty imperative, and Eliza Smythe, our physio who was with us, was treating me multiple times every day to make sure I could get through training so that I could get onto the start line feeling confident. So for me, the medical people, they're always the unsung heroes that sort of just work behind the scenes. They're never on the deck on the day, you know, catching you at the line or, you know, getting the pictures because they're so busy doing the work. So for me, I have to say a big, big thank you to those guys.
Also, I noticed in the documentary, your coach, also the way that he has to, you know, have to take into account just the variations that can happen just because of MS. I mean, that must also be important, just having a coach that, you know, because if you push yourself too hard, that could actually...
Yeah, that's right. You put yourself into a bigger hole, and it's just the relationship that Shane and I have had for 20-something years now meant that the lead into that prep, I just put all my faith in him. So there'd be many days, I speak about in the documentary, I'd turn up to training and say, I'm good to go, and he'd look at me and know that that wasn't true. So he would change things and I'd be very much like, I think we should do it. And he'd just say, no, I don't think we should. And I would always do what he told me to do because I really trusted that he had my best interests at heart.
So also in the film, we see just how fast the bikes move in full motion. And when you're putting the pedal down, I mean, pardon the pun, there's really a risk of quite serious damage. I mean, when you're travelling, 70, 75 kilometres an hour, how do you deal with the thought of the danger that, you know, when you're travelling so fast, does that sort of enter your head, particularly when you see a big crash?
I think the only time I think about it is when I see it. I otherwise try and block it out and just assume that won't happen to me. I always worry about it before I go in for a bunch race, but... Outside of that, when you're racing, you're not thinking about it. You can't. Otherwise, you couldn't start.
Yeah, I'm like a puppy dog. I don't really think I've got too much else to
do. So you have to be fearless during those times. You just have to...
Racing.
Yeah.
Not think about it. And I think at the World Championships just gone, I won my first World Championship and I was so excited after the end. I'm giving the other rider a high five and I actually stacked it in the middle of the corner and went down the slippery slide. So, and it wasn't until I stopped that I realised, oh, I just crashed. And I'd lost all the skin on my side of my body. So, well, not, that's a bit dramatic, but... It was a few couple big burns.
That's from the adrenaline, is that just all the adrenaline and you just sort of, you don't really thinking, like, you know, you're feeling
it? Yeah, well, yeah, I don't think much as it is, so that probably doesn't help.
In the documentary, the audience does get to experience firsthand what it is like when there is a pretty catastrophic crash on the track and what goes through the athletes' heads, what goes through quite literally along the track and what it feels like.
And the long process of rehabilitation after,
exactly, yeah.
Also in the film, I mean, we see just how important cycling is for maintaining physical fitness, but also for mental health. Anyone want to talk about that aspect of how important just cycling is, just to be able to sort of be able to connect with nature and, you know, just, you know, have the sort of free thoughts? I mean, that sort of seems to be also sort of explored in the documentary.
Yeah, so one of the big things that we wanted to explore was mental health and how cycling has helped those athletes as well. And through the research that we were doing and the interviews that we were doing with all the athletes, we did a whole series of Zoom interviews before we actually did the sit-down interviews mm-hmm. with the athletes. So Tim and I sat on Zoom and had a good chat with everybody. And through that, it really became clear for so many of the athletes, cycling really did save their life, and there are so many mental health aspects behind that and benefits, you know, being able to get out in nature, as you said before. Mm. And one of the things that Tim and I quite enjoy exploring is this idea of flow state, which was covered really well in the movie Soul by Pixar. Mm-hmm. Just really finding that thing that you love and really getting into that zone is another way of putting it. My brother Tim is a really keen skier, mm-hmm. and for him it's about flying down that mountain and feeling the wind on your face and letting everything else in your life, all of your worries and concerns, just fade away and just being really clear and in that moment. And we love points with these cyclists where they can find that. Alistair Donohoe is one of the athletes that we interview in the film, and he gets out for hours, sometimes 6-7 hours at a time, just riding out around country areas of Victoria and can just be with himself and answer many different questions in his life that he's had to deal with, any challenges. And so there's a lot of mental health stuff that we wanted to cover in the film, and I hope that comes across.
So also, obviously, as Paralympians, it must be great to be able to be an inspiration for other people with disabilities. Is it great to think that you have to lift other people up and, you know, prove that disability doesn't define you?
Well, I think that's what we hope we do. I hope we do.
One of my highlights of the Paris Paralympics was actually coming back to Australia and going to the welcome home ceremony in South Bank in Brisbane and just seeing how many people there were to support us and just seeing the little kids and how excited they were and how inspired they were. And what feels like not that long ago, that was me on the other side of the fence getting excited and just seeing how much joy us as athletes bring to people. And you quickly get reminded, like, yeah, the results is pretty epic and that sport's so much bigger than the result. It's about how it brings everyone together and just how it motivates people.
So, I mean, it's something I'm never going to know this, but so what's it like when you're on the podium and you're about to get that gold medal put around your neck? What are you feeling at that time?
Well, I was pretty happy. If you look at any of the podium pictures of me, I'm generally screaming and dancing around like a lunatic in Paris. I'm not always like that, but I was at that occasion. It just felt like it was really hard to get there, and in a different way to what it was for Tokyo. It wasn't just hard because of the performance side of things, it was hard because of all the medical stuff on top of that. There was layers of it, so it felt enormously joyous for me, and I think Corey was much the same. He was pretty joyful.
Yeah, no, I think every athlete stepping on top of the podium is going to have a different, like, experience. But, yes, I didn't have the medical struggles that Em's talking about, but I almost felt like a bit of an imposter being up there just because I'd only started cycling not that long before, and I'd trained so hard. Like, I'd never given something my all that much in my life. But being up there, I knew I still had so much faster to go and give. It was kind of like, well, I can't, like, so maybe imposter wasn't the right word, but I just couldn't believe I was actually, all this hard work actually got a good result. Like, your parents tell you do your homework and you kind of just listen to them, whatever. But if you actually do it, you're probably going to get good grades.
The secret to success is not such a big secret after all.
Yeah.
It's one step after the other, isn't it?
Yeah.
Keep going.
Yeah, do the work.
So what's it like the day after the event? Does your body just feel, do you just feel exhausted? Is your body sort of, what do you feel like, or you still feel exhilarated from the day after? What's the day after an Olympic event?
I think both of us will have a different response to this. I was fully cracked for days. I never came good again for a few months. So. Yeah.
No, I the next day I remember going down for the morning show. an interview with me and Em. It was very exciting, cool, but I hadn't slept that night, so you definitely didn't get the best me. And that was pretty rogue.
I can't even remember it, but I remember now vaguely being down there doing it with you, but I can't remember anything about it.
I remember getting ABC Sunshine Coast on the phone, and I'm just like, man, he's going, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, excited. I'm going, I haven't slept. I don't know what's going on. I don't even know where I am. But no, I was just, I was so excited, and I didn't know how to express myself yet. I still don't.
So is there lots of partying after the achievement, or is it you wait until everyone's finished their event and then have the big sort of celebration?
Well, yeah, it was kind of weird because, well, it wasn't weird at all. We had, so the track cycling event, I think, was on day two, but then we had our road race, which was on the second last day. So we nearly had a week and a half in between races, which is good because we could catch up on the sleep and Em could let her body catch up to where she was in
space.
Yeah,
I didn't quite get as much time off as you. I had, I had 4 days between IP and then had the time trial and then we had the road race. So it was a pretty, there was no celebrating at the first instance when we'd won. It was more once everything was done, people got to celebrate. Yeah. And Corey celebrated.